Hello, and welcome to the OnFIF podcast, a weekly discussion on key trends in investment and economic policy from some of the world's leading commentators. On this week's episode, we talk about the shifting global economy.
In the last 35 years, the most striking change in the world is that that world's economic center of gravity has been pulled out of the Atlantic Ocean and pushed east, but also the rise of many other emerging economies.
We talked to Danny Kwa, Lee Ka-shing Professor in Economics and Acting Dean at the Lee Kuan Yew School of Public Policy here in Singapore. Danny, welcome.
Hello.
Well, thank you very much, firstly, for joining us today. With regards to the shifting global economy, I know a lot of your work has both been on the shift from west to east, potentially, but also the shift in changes in technology. Perhaps first we could look at the geographical shifts and discuss what are the major forces reshaping the global economy and potentially the future global order. Now, much has been said recently about China's rise and America's possible decline. Do you see this as a defining trend of our age?
First, thank you for having me on this series. The rise of China, the potential perceived decline of America, is a huge story. One of the most striking graphic images that bankers, academics, policymakers have in mind is this chart of each country's total output, where China's GDP begins far below that of the United States, but then is seen to be rapidly converging towards America. And extrapolating that trend, depending on which series you use exactly, either China has already overtaken the United States in total output, or it will imminently do so. And that is a striking image that many people have in mind when they think about this large geographical economic change. But that picture is a little bit misleading. We have to remember that China is an economy four times the population of the United States. So very simple arithmetic tells us that even when that crossover occurs, the average Chinese will be still far poorer than the average American. In fact, arithmetic tells us, since China is four times the population of America, the instant that crossover happens, the average Chinese will have an income only one quarter that of the average American. That might not seem something to write home about, even though in terms of the aggregate footprint, it is a very large effect. What I find more interesting to think about in this image is a metaphor. And it's a metaphor that then takes us away from this image of the world as being locked in this G2 America-China kind of tussle, where it's only America on the one side and China on the other. And the image that I prefer is one that takes seriously the idea of the world's economic center of gravity. As a metaphor, everyone uses the idea that for the longest time, the entire 20th century, America, Britain, Western Europe were the significant economies in the world. So the world's center of gravity sat in the Atlantic Ocean. Some time ago, I decided to take this metaphor and make it literal. So I calculated the world's economic center of gravity. And what you discover when you do that is that in the last 35 years, the most striking change in the world is that that world's economic center of gravity has been pulled out of the Atlantic Ocean and pushed east, pulled by the rise of China, but also the rise of many other emerging economies. That world's economic center of gravity has in the last 35 years shifted 5,000 kilometers across the surface of our planet steadily eastwards. Now, what that tells me is that we shouldn't be thinking about the present and future history of the global economy as simply being America versus China. It's about, yes, America and the Western economies on the one hand, and China and many other emerging economies on the other. So that slightly more nuanced picture says that the great shift is a move from west to east, a move from developed to emerging economies, rather than simply this tussle between America and China.
No, I think that's very important to point out the development in the other emerging markets, especially in this region as well, but still with ASEAN only accounting for around 10% of the region's GDP, there is obviously a lot of weight put on the role of China and then also the third largest economy, Japan, and their changing role in the global order.
That's absolutely right. Part of what that shifting center of gravity picture tells us is that it's not just the presence of, say, Japan, which has been relatively stagnant. It is a first-class economy that operates, that's firing on all cylinders, but it's been relatively stagnant. So to account for the dynamic, it can't be just the very large economy that's Japan. it's also got to be the growth. And this is growth that's coming from everywhere. So let me give you a different visualization of this. Take the year 2000. For the 15 years before 2000, if you look at all the emerging economies in the world, over 150 of them, all together, they amounted in GDP to less than one-third of the combined GDP of the G7, right? All the advanced economies. And what's striking is that in the 15 years before the year 2000, that ratio, although it bounced around, was relatively constant. So of 150 countries taken all together, they were only a third of the seven traditional leader economies. Now here's the striking thing. Post-2000, that ratio steadily drifted upwards. It drifted upwards so rapidly that by 2017, that ratio has become one. The emerging world has now reached parity with the developed world when previously they stood at a massive distance. So it's that change rather than just a single large economy like Japan or any other. It's the change of the emerging world that's really the most striking. Now, you're absolutely spot on. If we're counting up GDPs within the growth of emerging economies, there's still a lot of discrepancies. There's still some that are richer, some that are larger, and others smaller and not so rich. So it's critical to try and take into account all these different nuances. But the bottom line is there's a great shift east in the world center of gravity, and a lot of that shift is accounted for by the rise of the emerging economy.
I agree. There's certainly a definite Easternization, as many analysts keep on referring to. So I suppose in declaring a new era for China during October's 19th National Congress last year, has President Xi Jinping in a way presented the Chinese system of governance as a model for other emerging economies to emulate?
I think that some observers would like to think that there's this attractive alternative in Xi Jinping's visualization of how a political economy operates, just as there are many observers who fear exactly that. And they fear that not just for the reason that there's this economic superpower out there, but because a Chinese system, or perhaps more accurately, a non-Western system, provides political challenge. It provides political challenge in the sense that here is an alternative set of rules under which potentially you can achieve economic success. That takes us away from a universalist, one-size-fits-all vision of the world. And part of the reason that there are people who fear this outcome is that they associate this non-Western system with a denial of many of core Western values that is reasonable to believe, values that everyone should subscribe to. So does the rise of China or the rise of a non-Western leader of the world, potentially, whether it's China or some mixture of the emerging economies or some mixture of Asia and China, some confusion, hierarchical system, does it now challenge our traditional values of freedom, free speech, rights of the individual, tolerance of others? And it is a profound undermining challenge to our mindset of how successful economies work, because in one telling of world history, an alternative system like China's should sap economic dynamism. It should be a system where eventually people rise and demand greater individual freedom. So the great challenge is not just that it's China, this country, or Xi Jinping. It is a challenge to political systems. It's a challenge to political systems that I think as economists, as financiers, as bankers, we often ignore at our peril because we reckon that the system that we are used to operating in will be the one that eventually dominates. Now we see a challenge. And it's a challenge that's profound and unsettling. And I don't think anyone has a clear vision or a clear narrative on how this is going to come out. There are many Western observers who subscribe to the view that a political economy of the kind we see in China, hierarchical, party-driven, responsibilities-oriented rather than right-centered, one that appeals to duties of the citizen, one that looks at networks of clients and patrons rather than a multilateral, open, transparent system. We look at that and we think that can't be a successful system. Many of the world's best economists are predicting the demise of the Chinese system for the last 30 years. And every year of the last three decades, they have been proven wrong. It's continued to grow. Now, there's no guarantee that that will be the case in the future, But it's a profound challenge to our system. So when we ask, when Xi Jinping gets up in Davos and says the things that he does and presents a pragmatic, pluralistic view of how we can govern economies, provide rights to our people, provide well-being to the citizens, it is a challenge at many levels. And so we worry about, do I think that it's an alternate system that works? I myself am open to the idea that pragmatism, pluralism, different strokes for different folks, specialized and differential treatment, all these things are fair play, and we should not hold on to a universalist one-size-fits-all system, that we do that to our peril. America, or the West more generally, has run a system that's open, transparent, rights-based, that has not prevented Western systems from voting in demagogues as political leaders. It's not prevented Western systems from allowing public infrastructure around them to decay. So it's an open game right now, in my view, and there are many different ways we can go.
Yeah, I think that's got some very fair points there. Just going back on your point about the medium to long-term outlook for China, and that it keeps on surpassing many analysts' predictions, and it has been for the last three decades. There are obviously recent historical examples where people have talked about the USSR as an economy that will overtake America, or Japan, maybe more recently as well, before China. Do you think the fates that those two economies faced, as you say, the stagnation in Japan and obviously what happened in the USSR, is the long-term outlook for China rosier than those two?
Well, Adam, as we say in finance, past performance is no guarantee of a future record. That authoritarian systems have failed in the past is no guarantee that a responsive authoritarianism, such as the kind we see in many Asian emerging economies, could well be successful. But by the same token, the fact that these systems have been successful in their own history is no guarantee that they will continue to be that. And constant diligence is needed. But I think we know the ingredients of what make things work. Economic exchange, allowing people to do the things they do best. That is to say, globalization and international trade, allowing people to make choices about the jobs that they hold, the work that they want to do, and giving them the incentive to accumulate, to improve their skills. There's practically nothing in world history across all of these systems that say that when people do that, their societies fail. In fact, quite the opposite.
Well, it's very good you brought up the issue of jobs and also people's choice to decide on their jobs. There's been a lot of talk recently in the last few months and years about the changing landscape of the job market, both because of AI and other developments in technology. How do you see those affecting not only the emerging markets, but those more specifically as we are in this region, ASEAN?
Really interesting question. Technology, robotics and AI, are they going to put all of us out of our jobs? Whether we're writing up news or whether we're teaching academic knowledge, will we all be replaced by a robot or an artificial intelligence? My own take on this is that I remember a time when all economies, developing and developed, were told that the only way they could guarantee continued performance was by raising productivity, by going for higher productivity. Well, guess what, folks? You got higher productivity. It's called technology, robotics, and AI. And we can't at this point turn our backs and say, oh, we didn't want them after all. Part of the idea of that we might be replaced by robots or an artificial intelligence is that output can remain the same or as high, and you and I are no longer working. Average productivity has increased by the fact that you and I have been replaced by robots. Or put that another way, higher productivity has driven us out of jobs. Now, that would be a terrible outcome if you and I were then starving on the streets. But the picture that because you're put out of a job means that you are displaced and homeless and no longer have sustenance is a fallacy. I mean, economists used to like to deride other people, ordinary people, because they fell into this so-called lump of labor fallacy. Without recognizing that as an economy grew, you could have more jobs for everyone. Well, here we're faced with a fallacy of our own. Does the fact that we do not have a job mean that we are economically destitute? Why should we be when productivity is high? The capacity to feed people, independent of whether they are working or not, is actually within our reach if our productivity trend keeps growing high. We should be looking at a future of jobless growth, not with fear, but with the possibility of welcoming it, because that would release human labor from having to work at jobs rather than do something that improves their minds, improves their well-being. I mean, we worry about job destruction. Many of the jobs that have been destroyed in the last 200 years are jobs that we are well rid of. We forget that in the Industrial Revolution, when writers worried about machines replacing labor, and then they turn around and the Luddites sought to destroy the machines, we forget that the jobs back then are not jobs we would want to have now. The fact that those jobs are gone means that we no longer have the dark satanic mills that people of that era wrote about. Jobs were soul-destroying, bone-crunching. They debilitated humanity. They killed our lungs. And many of those jobs were well rid of. We should look at the possibility of jobless growth because of technology, robotics, and AI, with the possibility that we might, from today, segue into a future that is prosperous for humanity, where the accumulation of material well-being is no longer the driving force for human progress, that we can devote our time to yet other things. That's one scenario. Of course, technology, high productivity alone will not guarantee that. We could also segue into a system where all of the technology, all of the machines, all of the productive capacity is owned by one or two individuals, and the rest of humanity is left destitute and homeless. So there are two different ways we can go. We can head into Mad Max kind of world, or we could head into a post-scarcity future where our needs are taken care of, not because we have jobs. Instead, we have delinked human dignity and human prosperity from having a job. The reason we couldn't do that in the past was because we didn't have high enough productivity. But now we have the potential for that. Now, that is all 10, 15, 25 years in the future. Between now and getting there, we do have to worry about jobless growth, social exclusion. Public policy has to come in and play a role. Enlightened public policy that sees, looks ahead, and says that there are futures that we need to be carving out that would leverage the good things that come from high productivity. Let's call it high productivity rather than robotics and AI, because robotics and AI scare people. High productivity is warm and fuzzy and welcoming. So we could head into a high productivity post-scarcity future, and all of us can do that, developing and developed economies.
So it's definitely a fear of the unknown, not only with what the likelihood of China dominating a global system, but the
AI.
And
if we study human history, the history of the Industrial Revolution, you know, we have forgotten that many jobs were awful jobs. 20 years from now, we might look at many of the things we do and say, I can't believe we did that, because they destroyed our physicality. They made us squint at computer screens. We were unable to sleep because the blue light from all our smartphones prevented us from getting a good night's sleep. And we don't have to do any of that anymore.
I suppose on from your point about the dark satanic times of the Industrial Revolution, obviously a lot of those jobs were done by young people.
Exactly.
And now we have very big changes in the demographic outlook of the world. There's a lot of aging populations.
Absolutely, absolutely. It was women and young children who were unprotected by labor laws that we had to build after that. But one of the reasons we were able to engineer a transition from an industrial society that needed huge amounts of labor input in the forms of women and young children was that productivity rose. We were able to make that transition.
Well, thank you very much, Danny, for joining us. This is hopefully the first of many of the Onford podcasts here from Singapore. And we look to be doing more, not only in Singapore, but ASEAN and Asia Pacific, with both investment practitioners, but also economic policy practitioners as well. So thank you very much, Danny.